You are listening to the Vital MX post-race show, presented by Decal Works.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Vital MX post-race show. Round 2 of 2024 Monster Energy Supercross is in the rearview mirror. Rain battered San Francisco's Oracle Park. We didn't exactly get crazy mud results, but we got something slightly different to the norm, and we'll get into that on this episode of the Decal Works post-race show on Vital MX, presented by Fox Racing and Beta. I'm Lewis Phillips, your host, as per usual, joined by Michael Lindsay. Hello.
Hello, hello, hello. I will apologize that we're getting this a day later. That pretty much all falls into my sorry excuse for the last 24 hours of my life. But we're going to move on past that and try to have some fun.
Yes, some of us have been sat by our microphones for hours on end waiting for that call.
So patient, so patient.
And you will be scorned for this, because not that we've discussed this. Next week you're out, I think, and replaced by Jamie Guida, his debut on this show. I feel it may be time for him to make an appearance. So that's something to look forward to.
Maybe you would rope in your MXGP compadre.
And that is?
Wheeler.
No, he's not going to San Diego. He's going to Anaheim 2.
Oh.
But that would be great, and maybe I will do that for Anaheim 2. Anyway, Decal Works, the title sponsor of this post-race show, loyal supporters of Vital MX, presenting all of our post-race content, interviews, shows such as this and whatnot. And Decal Works, of course, won the San Francisco Supercross with Chase Sexton. And for the defending champion to win a main event is, of course, no surprise. He is the defending champion for a reason. But you could see in his reaction post-race that this meant a lot. And considering where he was 1 month ago in the middle of December, I don't think he would have quite believed that he would be in this position so early in the season. And it was nice to see that emotion radiate through the smoke and mud and general horrid conditions after the main event, because we like emotion. And yeah, big win for Chase, big win for KTM, spiced up this 450 title fight nicely.
Yeah, that was interesting. Of course, just on paper, earlier win than last year for Chase. Chase started out with, I believe, a 3-5 last year. He's starting out with a 3-1, super consistent. Like I said, kind of almost a surprise to talk to him. I think, you know, not that in dry conditions he wouldn't have been capable. He was in it last weekend. He talked a little bit about some of the changes they made, mostly with the fork this weekend. To, you know, I on one hand, you're always thankful to win, but I could also tell that he was kind of wishing it was a dry race, because he has some things to confirm based on what he learned this week. But I will say that was one of the more interesting things talking to him after the race. I was kind of like, oh, cool, mud race, you won, but you know, you probably are. I'm curious in the back of my head how much he had progressed between round one and two. And that's where he seemed really generally excited, was with the progress he's made. He seems very excited to try to show that soon. But again, San Diego, looking forth at the forecast, might be a mutter as well. So we may not know till A2 what kind of progress that Chase X and the KTM crew actually made when it comes to dry conditions. But something funny I was going to bring up, you know, you think of good mud riders going into this. You know, a lot of people were posting memes about Aaron Plessinger, Justin Barcia comes to mind. Chase Sexton, I believe he has actually done fairly well in most of his mud races, hasn't he?
Yes, and of course, East Rutherford last year, he got out to the early lead, but was put down by Barcia, so that would have potentially been a better result than it was. I don't know whether it's time to stop theorizing who is a good mud rider. Because if you look at Chase and Jet, I would say that they are two of the riders in the sport with the most perfect style form on a bike. And it clearly worked very well for Chase in the mud and not so well for Jet. So,
yeah, but style and technique doesn't work. That's like Barcia's always been an amazing mud rider. It's about momentum and being okay, being loose. That's why like everybody shines towards Barcia being a good mud rider, is typically because he's okay with anything possibly happening, which was kind of weird with the mud we had this weekend, because it wasn't talking to a lot of the riders. You know, a lot of guys are like, man, it, even though it kept raining, it never really got I guess, proper sloppy. Like, there were still ruts that, like, just kept going down. Usually with that much continuous rain, you know, stuff starts to push out really bad. But I was surprised how deep and sticky it kind of was. I mean, we saw it basically, we'll get to it, but, like, from what I've heard, Volan's bike DNF wasn't actually a motor clutch issue. It was literally the mud was so sticky it jammed up the drivetrain and the bike wouldn't move anymore.
Yeah, honestly, it rained all day, but it was so fine and light that I don't think it really was ever heavy enough to turn the track to slosh. Obviously, East Rutherford last year was a
big rain, like that big rain we were talking about that was possible for the night show, which just turned into like 2 hours of constant. If it would have come down all at once, then it would have been sloppy. But yeah, it just kind of rained at the same rate for hours on end.
East Rutherford last year is a perfect example of a sloshy racetrack. It rained so hard there that there were puddles everywhere. And for the most part, riders were doing the jumps, jumping rhythms. And yeah, I think they had it downpoured before the 450 main event. It actually would have helped the riders, even though you'd think that most would be praying for the rain to disappear. That almost would have been the worst possible outcome. And I must admit, maybe it's in part because of the drama surrounding the lime and whatnot, but San Diego 2019 sticks out in my mind as the most horrific mud race. And I went back and watched the highlights last night just to confirm. And I feel as though San Francisco was worse. I really do. Like, even San Diego, the track was racier in spots and it didn't look as thick. The whoops were tough in San Diego 2019, but they were still there. We had got rid of them completely in San Francisco. So yeah, I would say this was the worst mud race in recent memory.
Bringing up that point, throughout the qualifying and the practices and even into the heat races, you as a man that has experienced plenty of mud races growing up in Britain kept saying, it's not really a mud race yet. I don't know if I'd call it a mud race. What time into the night show did you finally go, you know, I think it's a mud race?
No, it was always a mud race, but I like when it's a mudder, I want a real mudder. Belpig 2008, for instance. If you don't know what that is, Google it, because that is horrific. Like none of this slick track with riders on tiptoes doubling around. That's not a mud race. I want bikes stuck on the track and riders drowning and all of that good stuff. And we got there in San Francisco. I don't think it could have got much worse in hindsight.
I remember the first time you finally finally said, oh, I think it's a mud race, was there was literally somebody stuck all the way to their seat in a rut. And you're like, okay, it's a mud race. But to your point, like it's weird to say, but if it would have downpoured harder, in almost in a way it would have been easier. That's what I was trying to say, is like the dirt for some reason was so sticky with the amount of moisture it had, where if it rained really hard and actually created standing water, stuff would move. I felt like that was one of the main reasons that almost nobody was jumping anything, because they simplified the track. There was more of a run into things. I don't think anybody wanted to jump anything because the ruts were so sticky, and they basically, if there's an angled rut and it's sloppy, if you basically hit it with enough momentum, you kind of shift the rut going up the face, you at least have half a chance of going forward. The ruts were so stuck in their form. If they were sideways, you were going to shoot off the track. Like, other than that one step on at the end, nobody would even attempt anything, because the bike would literally go whatever direction the sticky ruts told you to. And then if you went into the wrong one, you would literally, again, it wasn't just that, oh, you were dog paddling around. The bike legitimately would get suction cupped down in. We were watching riders having to reach down, pick up the wheel, and, you know, lean it all the way on the side trying to get it out of ruts, because it would just stick in so heavily. So to your point, it sounds weird, is more rain would have made it an easier mud race, I think. I think we were almost on the worst possible conditions they could have been in.
Chase obviously made an impact in the first two laps. That was where the race was won, in my opinion. But if not there, it was him stepping onto the tabletop in the second rhythm. He was the only rider to do that consistently. Eli was doing it in the early stages and then almost looped out one lap and called it a day on that jump. But Chase was nailing it pretty perfect. And that was, unfortunately, the way the sectors were laid out, there isn't really a sector time that communicates that. But trust us, in person, that was really a nice game changer, and almost was made enough of an impact where every lap he could just manage it, do the jump, gave him enough of a buffer, manage it, rinse and repeat.
Oddly enough, who I saw do it almost every lap, and it was a weird one, and it reflects in his result being so odd, is Shane McElrath did it almost every single lap as well that I saw him.
To go back to what you were saying 5 minutes ago as well, from what I've heard, they did make massive improvements with the bike in the dry at the test track between Anaheim 1 and San Francisco. And I do think that if it was dry, then Chase would have been racier than what he was at Anaheim 1. This is just the vibe I'm getting from people close to the situation and even Chase himself. If it's not like, if he was unsure about the steps that were taken, he wouldn't have been so vocal about wanting it to be dry because wanting to see how good that was, you know? He would have just played it down a little bit. But he really made it known that if this was dry, I would be better because I am happier based on the last 7 days.
I think he mentioned, talking to him, he said like 2 weeks before A1, if you would have asked him how the first couple rounds went, he thought he was going to... He was in a position where he said he thought he was going to have to be really patient early in the season. Like, he was not expecting... Basically wasn't expecting good results for the first couple of rounds. Like, he was expecting to just have to log in some decent finishes and work on the bike. He mentioned that coming right into A1, they made a really big rear end improvement. And it sounds like even throughout the day, which we saw from that opening practice at A1 to later on, that they made quite a bit of improvement in the rear. But he said he said they still felt very far off on the front end. And that's where they made most of the improvement this week. He said they just did a massive amount of fork testing, and he seemed very happy with the direction they went, because he said at the end of A1, he was still very unhappy with the front end. And that's pretty much where they put all their focus this week, or this past week.
Fun fact as well, who would have thought Chase has sat on a 7-point lead in the championship, and the last time we had a lead that big was Jason Anderson in 2018 after two rounds. And the last time that we had a lead bigger than 7 points was Roczen in 2015. So, somehow, despite the drama of December and all of the question marks and all of the talk around the paddock, Chase has sat on one of the most significant points leads after two rounds that we've seen in the last decade. So, funny how things work.
So, Jet Lawrence, not a great mud rider. Where do we stand?
I don't know, because I mean, he was it's a completely different kettle of fish, but East Rutherford last year in 250s, he was fine. I mean, he wasn't running away with it, and obviously 250 in the mud is very different to 450 in the mud, and obviously a lesser field as well, so barely comparable, but obviously he can ride mud, and again, much sloshier there, and so not really comparable to what we had in San Francisco. But this is what I kind of meant at the top, like, I feel if you run that race again and Jet gets a start, he would have been fine. I'm kind of going to stop all of the talk about who's a good mud rider, who's excited, because I do think it's just the start, and I do think that effectively decides the race. I mean, yes, it was a crazy mudder, but in both classes, the winner led every single lap, and I think that just underlines how important a start is in a mud race.
Yeah, I will say that's still kind of interesting. So you watch the start, of course, Chase rocketed out of the gate, and Chase admitted in the press conference that he basically sort of he said he thought he saw the gate flinched, so he just went for it, and he said luckily it did drop right after he thought he saw it flinch, which he joked that he's done that a couple times, and he admitted that it's probably going to bite him in the ass here soon. But then he went deep into the first corner. There's some couple great photos of him like almost going over the bars. He got into some pretty deep mud more towards the outside of the corner. So Kenny snuck inside and was going to come out with the lead. And then he basically admitted his tall rear brake that he stomped on it and killed the bike. So Kenny ended the first lap in 10th. He was worse than that after the start. He was 15th or 16th. So it is interesting that Kenny kind of falls in a weird category of got a great start, but kind of didn't because he got shuffled back immediately, but still made it to a podium.
If not and Chase,
as we talked about, then... At one point, I thought Kenny was going to move all the way up to potentially challenge Chase, but once he got to Eli, the momentum went out the window. But at one point in the race, I thought he was going to win the race, but I thought he was going to get towards the back of Chase. Would you agree?
Yeah, if it wasn't going to be Chase who won, it would have been Kenny. They were the best riders, quite clearly, I think. I don't think that Eli was the best rider or on that level. I think he was more just steady and effective. Whereas Chase and Kenny had a speed advantage over everyone. I think that is abundantly clear. But just like, I feel like this is an interesting comparison, and just to double down on how important a start is in a mud race. Not that this is breaking news, it's common sense, but just to double down on that, Jet was sixth officially at the end of the first lap. So, you know, that's a good start. He's above mid-pack. And on the first two laps, he lost 6.5 seconds to Chase on lap one and 5.5 seconds on lap two. And that just, that there you go. That's the difference of having a clear track versus not having a clear track in a mud race. And okay, obviously Chase was also better in the mud and more effective, but that's also, I think that paints a picture quite effectively.
Yeah. I was going to make one note with Eli that I thought was interesting, because normally, now that I think of Eli Konigemar, because of momentum, heavy on throttle, but because it was sticky, one thing I noticed with Eli was Eli, there's a lot of guys that would go into certain ruts and tiptoe and basically almost get stuck. Eli is one saving grace that made him like kind of steady Eddie in the race is his just extreme nature with throttle, is he kind of would just never tiptoe in anything. In sections where other guys would tiptoe and get stuck, he would just be hammering it as usual. So he never really got hung up. He wasn't pretty from section to section sometimes. It wasn't the most greatest thing to watch, but he did a very good job of just kind of continuing to hammer down. So he never really got himself that held up. He wasn't at times that fast, but he just never was getting really stuck anywhere.
Yeah, he was just effective. And Eli, of course, a great mud rider, winner of San Diego 2019, second in East Rutherford from memory. So yeah, Eli, a great mud rider, but he kind of finished where he started. This is a pattern. This is a pattern in a mud race, and especially a mud race like that. I think that East Rutherford, you saw the difference of being willing to push the limit and jump certain stuff, again, because of how sloshy it was. Whereas this was just a case of consistency, not falling, staying upright, like very simple playbook on how to, what skills are needed to win this race.
One thing I'd be curious with Eli, he did mention, I mean, he basically admitted that A1 was just terrible, that he rode tight, got arm pump, just rode absolutely terrible. He mentioned kind of going, you know, coming into the season, he was talking about going to new tires, finally changing his whole bike setup around that, and, you know, really trying to push himself to progress, because he thought that, you know, Jet and Chase and these guys were going to progress, so he wanted to not stay static. But then he said this week, you know, that he basically, he didn't say what, but it kind of makes me either wonder if it was tires or something he's done with the setup to Chase, that is, he said he basically went back to something he had run before because he was so uncomfortable at A1. I'm curious, again, similar to Chase, once we get to dry, how effective were Eli's changes from A1? Like, how much progress did the team make? And I need to look more carefully next week and see if we can figure out, like, kind of what is it that he backpedaled on.
I believe Eli, one of the only top riders to not run a scoop in the main event.
Yes, that is true. I believe he did not, from what I saw.
Hard to really nail down, but from what I've seen and the people I've spoken to and the research I've done, I believe Eli was the outlier, and which is crazy to me, because I would think that a scoop would be a no-brainer and not even a discussion. But obviously, he had some sort of thinking, and I wish that we could have asked him about that.
Scoops are interesting because I think it depends what type of lines you're trying to take during that race. Now, Kenny talked a lot about squaring up and trying to ride sideways across all the ruts. If you have slop berry to stay on top of, the scoop is good because it'll paddle through. Now, if you stay in lines, the ruts basically will go to the base material. The scoop is really bad when you get to the base because it just spins so badly. So there is a hit or miss of it in a mud race. It kind of depends what you're going to do with the tire and how you're going to ride. There are situations where being on the scoop would be detrimental depending on what you're trying to do.
I mean, if I was riding, would have been a scoop. Chase was good at Anaheim 1. He was great in San Francisco. No matter what happens in San Diego, I've also struggled with that a lot. Two sands back-to-back, really hard for me to get my head around.
mud races back to back. Hopefully not.
I think San Diego will be fine, but like I found myself thinking, like, oh yeah, San Diego, no, San Francisco.
You thought San Francisco would be fine midweek.
No, San Diego is going to be fine. I've done my research.
big weather guy here.
And I've forgotten what I was saying. So Chase, no matter what happens in San Diego, I think we know that Chase is fine. It's more of a question of just how good he will be. Whereas Eli was obviously further off in Anaheim 1 or at Anaheim 1. So Eli is still a question mark. I'm sure that San Francisco did great things for his confidence. Momentum, obviously, always nice to get the monkey off of your back or first podium since a serious injury. So all of that is helpful, but I still have question marks and I will be watching Eli closely and I'm not sold that San Diego will go this well. Agree?
Agree.
I mean, it's only logical.
Second. I'm just so curious because he has a much bigger range of a progress he needs to make from A1. But I just want to see how much they made. Because that's also telling tale of like how quickly if they come in next week and let's say if it is dry and he's third or fourth, like that's a lot. That's a big step from what was it, 9th at A1. But if it's 5th, it's like, okay, it's a bit of a step, but there's still definitely a bigger chunk that needs to be made. I'm just curious to see how much of that gap they cut down.
I would like to go on record as Kenny wins San Diego. We talked about how good he was in the mud, and also obviously he was great at Anaheim 1. And as I said to him on press day, I feel as though he's oozing confidence. And if not confidence, he's oozing content. And I think that's where Kenny is dangerous. So I think that Kenny is on the rise, and I think that he will win. If he doesn't win San Diego, he'll win Anaheim 2. I feel like we're on the verge of a Kenny win. Put it this way. If we don't have a repeat winner in Chase or Jet, the next winner will be Kenny, in my mind.
When was the last time you remember Kenny being like this happy and content with racing?
Well, that's what I said to him on press day. My exact question was like, stood here before me, I feel as though you're oozing confidence and comfort and just you're in a great place. And I said, when was the last time you felt this content with your entire package, not just your riding, but your situation, your presence at the races? And he kind of, it's not that he disagreed, but he replied with the canned answer of, I'm not letting myself get too high. I'm not letting myself get too low. I'm trying to stay middle of the road, maybe lane assist Kenny. I think that if he's being truthful and that's actually where he is, that is almost a sign of just how comfortable he is because he's happy to ignore the lows and ignore the highs. If you're uncomfortable, you're more likely to grip onto the highs and ride that wave of momentum as hard as physically possible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, now that I actually look back on his comment, I feel as though that in itself painted a picture of confidence and content. So, yeah. Suzuki, confident as well. Two riders in the top four for the first time since Arlington in 2015, which also included Kenny, of course, second on that night. Tickle? No, Blake Baggett.
Oh, back when they still had Yoshi Suzuki. Okay, yeah.
And, you know, props to Shane. Great ride. Disappointing that he didn't get on the podium because the opportunity was definitely there, but ultimately not quite there.
Remember how many discussions did we have last year when Shane was getting 15th, 17th every single weekend, 18th, and we're like, does he have a 450 career? Does he have a career outside of WSX?
Yeah, I actually really want to interview Shane because I felt as though Anaheim 1 was better. Okay, the end result was nothing to shout about, but he was definitely racier than he was at the start of last season. And now with this, I feel like Shane is forging a nice path. I don't expect him to be top 10 every week, but he's definitely doing himself justice. And, you know, it's easy to look at Shane McElrath fourth and be like, wow, what a result, incredible for him. But he was fifth in Denver last year, seventh in Salt Lake, sixth in somewhere. East Rutherford? Or was that? No, East Rutherford, he was sixth. Yeah, he was good in the mud fair as well. So, you know, although this is great, it's not actually an outlier. He was onto something at the end of last year.
Yeah, but it also makes sense talking to him because early last year, even though Kenny had good results early last year, talking to him and Chiz, like, as we all know, they were changing the bike setup so much early in last year. And every time I'd ask anybody on the team about Shane, they're just like, and not in a bad way, Shane definitely came across as one of those riders that just has, is not either not a great test rider or doesn't know what he wants. And he was just kind of going with the flow and would get the leftovers from Chiz and Kenny as they solidified, like, this is a good idea. Then Shane would just get it. But it didn't sound like he was the kind of guy that led with direction. So now that the HEP program has more of a solid package, more base notes to go off of, et cetera, I think it's really helped Shane because he doesn't, again, he's not the kind of guy that leads that direction. So now that they know more what they're working with, I think we'll see an overall better Shane throughout the year.
So was Plessinger overhyped? Did we read too much into this?
I think so. And that's why I was like, again, everybody plays into, and I did for fantasy and everything, was like, okay, Plessinger and Barcia, amazing mud riders. Plessinger could get the first win, blah, blah, blah. And again, it's so funny to think of mud because even watching the race, again, I'm not trying to like play so much that, but there is different types of mud races. There are sloppy mud races and sticky. And for some reason, I think of Aaron and Barcia sliding around when it's really wet. I don't know. Just did. Fifth is still great. I mean, Aaron's had two very solid results to start the season, but very disappointed. I really, maybe I bought into it too much, especially for starting fourth place or ending the first lap in fourth place. I thought, you know, he had a chance, but the pace just wasn't there.
Okay, let me throw this at you now that I think. We've seen a lot of Plessinger mud rides outdoors where he's been great. Mm-hmm. I cannot recall a 450 Supercross where that's been muddy, but he has killed it at. Okay, he was second in Salt Lake City. That was ish muddy, nothing in comparison to San Francisco, and also a weaker field, so whatever. And then, yeah, apart from that, he was at San Diego in 2019 on a 450, 10th on that night. So maybe that's it. Maybe 450 Supercross in the mud. Not so effective versus 450 outdoors in the mud.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the same breath, nod to Plessinger. Pole position for the first time in his career. Never done it in 250s, never done it in 450s, never done it outdoors.
Yep.
Plessinger and Barcia, two riders that just do not know how to do one quick lap. And it's actually really quite, I really want to get into the mentality behind it with both of them. Because considering, well, more so Barcia, you think of Barcia revving, bouncing off a rev limiter, one lap, raw speed. That's kind of what you think with Barcia. And then you look at his qualifying times, and he's just never, well, not never, but rarely, rarely there. He has had some pole positions in 450s, so better than Aaron, but still not, yeah, just funny how that works, how you can have such a great racer and it doesn't translate to such a great qualifier. You'd think it would be somewhat similar.
It's been brought up to him a few times. The same thing. He just kind of laughs. He's like, yeah, I'm not a great qualifier. And it's like, but your riding style, you would think differently. He's like, yeah, I'm just not a great qualifier.
Tip of the hat to Ferrandis. Very similar start to last year. Almost identical. I will have more Ferrandis feedback when we get to round 5 and 6. And he's still doing this. Because we have seen spurts of Ferrandis' greatness, and actually always early in the season. I think back to his first podium on a 450, that was round 2, and then the year, his sophomore year, which was 2022, he was on the podium the night that Chase won his first Supercross, again, early in the year. For whatever reason, Ferrandis is actually quite good early on in a 450 season. So come back to me in a couple of weeks when he's still doing this and I'll have more. But for now, good job.
No, I think he has always, again, he's looked down on his 450 Supercross results, but he has started seasons well. It just always ends up with an injury. Still talking to him, the most interesting thing is he said he doesn't feel like he has near-death moments in his current setup. So he's, I think, more confident that he can keep riding this wave. He was very bummed out after winning the heat race and having a great start. Terrible start in the main, went down in the first corner, or got held up in the first corner. Actually, he got jammed into somebody, and then he crashed two more times, but he had a couple laps during the race where he was the fastest guy on track. He's overall happy. I know the team was thrilled because they threw together that bike pretty late, and they were one of the most nervous people I could see when it comes to water and mud and things that could go wrong. But very motivated, Dylan, and congrats to those guys for getting a heat race win.
On that note, this is a good time to mention, we had 8 races on Saturday night, as we always do, of course, and 6 different nationalities won those races, which is quite, I feel like that's rare. I didn't look into it.
For all the, I wouldn't say crap, but the whole, oh, what would you rather, you know, the discussion, this pops up, whether it's social media or former, what would you rather win, a Supercross title or a world, you know, an MXGP world championship? And I see people quote that, well, you race, you know, people from all over the world, MXGP, blah, blah, blah. I don't know, we got quite a few nationalities up front in Supercross, so.
Yeah, Spain and France won the 450 heats. Sweden won the LCQ. And 250s, I can't remember, but there was some nationality. Oh, Japan won a heat.
Yep.
And there must have been another one for me to arrive at 6, but I can't remember. So there you go. Have that.
Has anyone from Spain ever won anything in Supercross heat race? I mean, because I brought this up with somebody, and they said Joaquin Rodriguez, and I was like, I'm pretty sure Rodriguez was Portuguese, but I could be wrong. I thought he was from Portugal.
Yes, I think he was from Portugal as well. Well, Prado put on Instagram that he made history, and I presume so that's what the history he made.
I figured he meant for Spanish rider to win a heat race or something. I figured that's what he had to have meant.
Speaking of Prado, in person, the first lap of his heat was incredible. Watching it on TV, the first lap of his heat was incredible. Yeah, very cool to see. Obviously, they don't register a lap time the first go around, which is very sad because I would love to see the difference from that one lap. And again, that one amazing lap to start the heat kind of gave him the buffer he needed to win that race. The race was won on the first lap.
Hey, back to your thing about good mud riders versus bad, just reading too much in the hype. Jorge Prado, great mud rider, right? We discussed this so much in the press box. Great mud rider.
He's too.
I'm joking. Okay, we all were like, known for being a mud rider.
First of all, I think that the reason he's not great in the mud is that he's very calculated. Size.
Yeah, too technical.
He thinks a lot on the bike, so I think that when it rains, he maybe takes stock of the risk more so than other riders. And then also, I was very interested to speak to him about the differences of racing motocross in the mud versus supercross, because obviously for everyone else, you don't really think about it, whereas that's actually, Prado can offer a fresh perspective. And he said that the biggest difference, I mean, it's not a surprise, but the biggest difference is in motocross, everyone carries momentum and speed, which then makes one fast line. In supercross, there's no opportunity to get the speed up, so there is never a dry line and never anywhere to go. You're just constantly trying to build speed in mud, which is recipe for disaster. And because of that, you don't really get any sort of race line or dry line. And he said he struggled with that, but not too much, because quietly, he made nice progress in the main event. So, yeah, good for Prado. You know, he put his balls on the line to come here, do this on a 450, and I'm glad that he gets to go home. He's not going home yet, obviously, but I'm glad that he gets to go home with some sort of success in his pocket.
We were joking about this before. I mean, me and you have both said it. We think it's a foregone conclusion what he'll do next year. This isn't really a tryout. But if at any point his mind was not made up, it has to be made up now. Winning heat race, it has to be made up.
I was really curious to look into this because his post about winning the heat had a lot of likes. And I was like, well, if that post in 24 hours has more than his post about winning the championship, the MXGP championship, then that paints the picture. And it did. In 24 hours, Jorge Prado's post about winning the heat race had more likes than his post about winning the world championship.
There's a part of me that would really love him to come here for kind of a synergy like MotoGP. Of course, MotoGP, Spanish rider. It's been times in Spanish, but Spanish has been so dominant there. With him in MXGP, there has been some strong Spanish riders, of course, in MXGP, but we've yet to have that in Supercross here, and that's something I'm really looking forward to. It's such a minor detail, but just the fact that, I don't know, the synergy to MotoGP and other great sports, having a high-level Spanish rider in driver in F1, MotoGP, things of that nature. We don't have one in U.S. Supercross. So again, just for that kind of vibe and feel of, no offense, Supercross being the most premier thing you can win in our version of the sport. It'd be very, very cool to have him.
Webb has the least to show for just how good he's been. He definitely wins that award. The award that no one wants.
So I'm actually surprised his result, and I'm trying to flash back to when he hit the ground, but he was riding so good at certain points throughout the day. I was very surprised at the end, kind of with, I don't know, some shuffling around that happened later on, that he ended up where he did in the main.
Yeah, it's a shame because he's, what, 18 points down now? Let's see here, 27 to 45. Yeah, I think that's 18. That's a long way down after just two rounds, and he's riding maybe better than ever. So that sucks for him. But with how well he's riding, maybe he can claw his way back towards the front. I mean, it's not out of the question. He's been that good through two rounds. So ignore the results with Cooper Webb. Just focus on the actual riding, especially if you're a Webb fan, because you will find a lot of comfort in that. Anderson did well to rebound to 12th. Again, doesn't look like much on paper, but it very easily could have been a DNF for him. One point of curiosity that we will never get to the bottom of is that if you look at the sector times in the main event, Anderson was 1 second and 2/10 faster than anyone else in segment two.
Is that where you could ride alongside the jump? The rhythm line?
Even more perplexing is that I looked into it and he had the four fastest times in that segment, and they were all similar sort of gap to the rest of the field. So count me as having one eyebrow raised.
I had this discussion. I can't remember if it was with you or Steve. I kept saying, I'm like, how many times could you see guys eventually get so tired and they'd launch off the side of either the first rhythm lane or the second, and they would just cruise really long, you know, really slow along and get down at the end? I'm like, wonder how many times you could get away with that during the race and nobody would bat an eye. Like, cause I definitely saw Jason off the side one time, and I saw a couple guys do it two or three times, and they weren't pinning it. Like I said, they would just cruise along. And under any other circumstances, you'd be losing time. But the main rhythms were literally so slow that you could just ride alongside the track in first gear with your hand on your leg and still probably set a better lap time, segment time.
Well, even more to add evidence to this case, I went back and looked at East Rutherford, and there was one segment where he did exactly the same thing and had the fastest times in this one segment.
There's a trend.
That were way faster than the rest of the field. But again, the result wasn't great. So I'm just very one eyebrow raised. We'll never get to the bottom of it. But yeah. And for, again, more evidence, in all of the other segments, there is not such a big difference between the fastest rider and the second fastest rider. So just putting that out there, do what you want with it. Just here to present the evidence. I am not the jury, just the lawyer. I want to give a shout out to Derek Drake. He's been solid through two rounds. And you know what? I wish he was a better interview, because that's a great story to tell. But yeah, just wish he was a better interview. Leave it there because otherwise if I say more, then that's quite harsh. But yeah, great story to tell, and a great first two rounds for him, as well as the Bar-X Toyota Redlands Suzuki team. 14th place, Christian Craig. And of course, Christian Craig wears Fox Racing, a presenting sponsor of this podcast. 2024 marks Fox Racing's 50th anniversary year, marking 50 years since Jeff Fox paid $300 for the infamous Foxhead logo and changed the game forever. Celebrate 50 years of looking forward with Fox. Here's to the rides, innovations, and victories to come. Hello, future. And the Fox Racing gear that all of the guys were running was very sick.
The Grand Prix Cycles kit.
A contender for the best gear of the weekend. Not that you could really see it through the mud, but when everyone was clean, definitely a contender. So let's give Fox Racing that award. I was very concerned for Christian Craig after the first lap, because I think he came through, if he wasn't last, he was close to last. And after the way that Anaheim 1 went, you know, that's just another unlucky situation. And I feel like he's had to deal with a lot of those. But coming back to 14th was, you know, that's good. I feel like that is something. It could have gone a lot worse. And yeah, I hope and pray that he can have a solid San Diego, because he has been beat down one too many times since joining the 450 class. And
I'm hoping and praying for the entire Rockstar Husky 450 team. Him and Malcolm are 17th and 18th in points right now. It's God, for the high of how RJ started the season, the 450 truck is on a low of low right now. Just not both capable of so much, but so much going on for them.
Well, before we get to Malcolm, I spoke to Craig after the race. I was surprised that he was willing to do interviews. So tip of the hat for that. I said to him, the fans want to know, none of us in the world know what happened to you at Anaheim 1. So please explain. And he didn't really give an answer, but the impression that I got was that he pulled off out of frustration and he could have continued, because there was a lot of, I would do it differently, not the best decision I've made, you know, a lot of that sort of talk. So filling in the blanks, I kind of get the sense that after his tip over early on and the bike was bent, he was frustrated and just, yeah, pulled off. That's what I deciphered. Maybe that's wrong, but yeah, there wasn't a point blank explanation. But the only way is up. Malcolm Stewart. Now, in our preview show, we had the discussion about the fact that he only has 4 podiums, the same number as Adam Cincirillo and the same number as Aaron Plessinger. And maybe people think that he has more than that. And not to pile on here, but he's only had 6 pole positions in 89 450 starts. And I just feel as though, again, the Malcolm Stewart raw speed, he can be the fastest guy. It's so overplayed that I feel like we've all been tricked into thinking that he's been the fastest qualifier 20 million times. And it's just a matter of time before he gets a win, when in reality, we're nowhere near that. The last time that he was in the top 10 in a main event was the last round of 2022. Now, admittedly, he's only raced 4 rounds since then, but still, the point stands. Those 4 rounds have not gone well. And you know what? 2 rounds this year, he was 10th in timed qualifying at the first round, 9th at the second round. So even that isn't going great. There's not much to cling on to here in the positive column. And, you know, I don't know. Please talk.
I'm surprised, because you are usually the king at finding something positive to talk about. So when there isn't, I'm very concerned. I do hit the panic button if you can't find something.
Am I the king of positivity? I've never been called that before, but I'll take it.
Most of the time not, but if you really try hard, you're usually the king of finding something to grasp on. You find straws to grasp at of positivity when you want to. So when you can't, that concerns me. I agree. I'm very lost at what to say. The same thing. On one hand, you could be like, well, of course, 2022 was his last result. He got hurt early, but it's just not trending in a good direction. So again, I don't know what to say, how to feel, especially again, qualifying hasn't been good. I don't know if segments have been particularly good. It's just like, this is not, like I said, we've had like 2 stages of Malcolm. We had Malcolm, it was blinding fast, could run, you know, lead heat races till he got tired. Everybody's like, he could win the main if he could put this, you know, the fitness behind this speed. We had that Malcolm. Then we had the super consistent Malcolm. Was it 21 when he was top 5, like 13 rounds or something? And then we don't have either of those right now. Like, both Malcolms are gone. I don't know what Malcolm Stewart we have right now.
I can't remember if I said this last week, but I have said it before, I think, recently, and I'll repeat it. Is it possible that
he hit a ceiling?
Yes. Again, yeah. And I'll go back to it. Is it possible that 2022 was the peak and we just all presumed there was more to come, when in reality there isn't? And you know, not to pile on here, but I'll do so. He signed a 2-year deal with Husqvarna, and I just wonder, like, is that's got to be based off of practice speed in the middle of the week predominantly, because there's not much here. I mean, again, we're all saying, like, when's he going to get a win? It's coming. This is the year. 89 starts on a 450. He's led 13 laps. That's not a rider who's knocking on the door and coming close.
Well, it's crazy to think 22, like, how far into his career that was. Again, huge, just the how consistent he was in 22 was insane to me. And again, gets hurt early in 23, so the team had to have seen qualifying speed. They knew what he did the year before, and they had to be thinking the same. Like, well, consistency there, if we can mix up the speed, we're there. So they re-upped him for 2 years, and it's just kind of lost right now. Now, it does make me wonder, because that late in his career to get to that point, like, was that the best he'd ever be? And I don't want to be harsh and say yes, but there's a part of me, it's like, it would make sense. Like, it would make sense. It could happen, which would be a definite bummer. Like, you always want to see the best for guys. So it's, and if that was where it tops out, damn. Because I think, you know, between the team, the sponsors, himself, like, the expectation is to do better than that. Like, that was a stepping stone. But if that is the reality, dang.
Well, here's another point that kind of drives that point home. His first year in Supercross was the same time as Eli Tomac. And is anyone talking about Eli Tomac as being on the rise? And there's a new level coming, and here we go, we're building. No, but they're at exactly the same points in their careers.
That's what I'm saying. And Anderson, and Eli, Barsha, all these guys that are 30 going on 31 that have hung it out this long, those guys have already found their success, and we're not. Like I said, we're talking about Malcolm in a very different light, so that's what's kind of weird. Like I said, it's so late in his career to be having this conversation. It would be unique if he does it. It definitely would buck the trend, but that also makes it a question, because it's like, well, if this isn't a common theme, you know, question marks if it can happen.
Yeah, and I think, like, even I I find it difficult to comprehend that he had his first season in Supercross as Tomac, because, you know, fun-loving Malcolm, joking, vibrant. He doesn't give off the vibe of a veteran, and I think that makes you think that he was making his debut in Supercross in 2015. And yeah, not the case. So, put it this way. Of all the 450 riders, if San Diego doesn't go well, this is the rider I'm most concerned about.
Yeah, the one other ride we kind of skipped around, I was so bummed not to have a dry round. I just wanted to see, of course, like, what could happen. Hunter, I really wanted to see, like, I wanted to see what Hunter could do after rebounding after what happened at A1.
Yeah, I'm not so concerned about Hunter. I think
I'm not concerned. I'm just saying I'm bummed. I wanted to see it. Like, not concerned. No, but Malcolm's on the highest of the concern list.
I'm not even, like, eager to see what Hunter has coming, because I'm like, it will come. Like, maybe not San Diego, maybe not A2, but by Detroit, you know, I'm like, we'll see it soon enough, so I can wait. It will come. You know, that's my sort of approach. Thank you to Decal Works, Fox Racing, and Beta for their support of this podcast. Beta. Vital MX is proudly supported by Beta Motorcycles, which has been a family-owned company since 1905. Beta manufactures the finest enduro, trials, dual sport, and motocross motorcycles that are known for their top quality and rideability. I can vouch for that, actually. The MXGP riders say that the Beta handles like a mountain bike. Their newest model, the 450RX, is the first four-stroke motocross model built by Beta. It was designed to offer a ride that is more forgiving, with a rare combination of premium performance and undeniable appeal. Check out betausa.com for more information. You'll notice I'm saying Beta. That was a request. Very hard for me.
Oh.
Very hard for me. Have you ever watched The Office?
Yes, I love The Office.
You know the episode where they get bought by Sabre and they make the song?
Yes.
But they make the song as if it's called Sabre. Yes. And then they find out it's Sabre, and it's like, that's me with Beta. Like, I'm all ready and I'm all gung-ho, and then they're like, oh, it's Beta. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to try and do this. That's our read from Beta. What they didn't mention is that they have the Ben Watson on the 450 RX, and that sells motorcycles. I'll tell you, get on the train or get left behind, or get on the wagon. I should say that's terrible of me, isn't it? Moving on, 250s. Funny how long it's been since Jordan Smith won a main event. Like, and you know what? I don't know why, but he was so good last year that I kind of like believe that he won a main event last year, but I guess like obviously not, but he was that good last year where in my mind I have to say, to tell myself, no, he didn't win last year.
He didn't, but it was, sorry, I thought you were still going. It was really interesting because now he carries, of course, red plate this weekend. I walked right up to him like, when was the last time you had a red plate TLD? And I again, Jordan Smith, self-asker, he literally looked at me and goes, yeah, I had the red plate one time at TLD and that's it for my entire career. I was kind of a little shocked. I thought, I remember he carried a little more than that, but Jordan solid all day, good in qualifying, doing the main, held it together, no issues. Kind of surprising because he admitted to basically being an awful mud rider. But I think he just, from talking to him, listening the way, sounds like just positivity. Just carried the right attitude to make it happen.
I was critical of Jordan Smith going to Star. And I admit I was wrong. He was, as I said, he was great last year. He's even better this year. And he's miraculously found his way to his best form, if not better, which is ridiculously hard to do after the 6 years of struggles that he had. I mean, just think how bad it went for him on Pro Circuit. Like,
terrible season ending injuries, like round one, round two in for a couple years.
To turn it around and get to this point is incredible. And I think that Jordan deserves all of the applause and accolades and props and all of that stuff. So yeah, just wanted to point out once again that I was wrong and Jordan deserves credit.
What's interesting to me is even his, I would say, placement almost in the hierarchy at Star. I remember, again, when they hired him, I kept trying to explain to people, again, there were so many people up in arms about it. It was like, hey, the team at that time was kind of going through a reset. They had all these young kids with, you know, Jay Coop and Nichols movement, all these guys. And it's like, Jordan has won and has gone down to the championship battle. They needed somebody that was capable of that. They have youth. They had plenty of kids to build up. And I remember saying, like, hey, it's a good choice. It makes sense on paper, but it might be short term. It just gives them the opportunity. And, you know, Jordan's going to have to earn his keep. He could be one, basically almost like the first person to be pushed out when more kids come up. I would argue at this point, he's, you know, because I think at the end of this season, if I remember right, I believe Bennick and Deegan are the only two riders on the team with contracts passed this year. I could be wrong, but I was told that even recently. And I would say Jordan is maybe the closest person on the list to retaining their, you know, is the most guaranteed to retain their spot at this point.
Personally, who is your pick for this title?
I, you know, moderate, it throws off so much with RJ's knife. I still have to go, RJ is my pick. I think Levi might be more in it than I thought he was going to be this year. I knew Levi would be good. I think he could be more in it week to week. And then Jordan, I think originally Joe was my second behind RJ, but Joe just took a huge hit with the points. Not that Joe won't be good the rest of the season, but I would say hierarchy actually couldn't win the title. I'd go RJ 1, Levi 2nd, just slightly over Jordan.
We definitely didn't give Jordan enough credit in the title race after Anaheim won. So definitely let's not. Just start by saying he is now in it.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Sorry, he's got the red plate, so I didn't need to say that. But
obvious.
RJ is still my pick. If Levi wins this title, Levi wins it by being on the podium every single week with like one or two wins. I think that's going to be Levi's MO.
That's kind of what I'm picturing. I'm not picturing him just nailing down wins left and right. There's just kind of a consistent good place. Like, there's sort of a vibe I get because, like, Jordan's Jordan. I could see Jordan having a bad race. RJ's had a bad race. Joe had a bad race. I could see Levi, if he did get this, would just be a win or two, but just being super consistent.
if Jordan comes out and is this good again in San Diego, it might be on. And I'll tell you what, though, it seems like the champion will come from RJ, Jordan, or Levi. Whoever it is, that's a cool story.
Hey, how cool is that? I'm sure you saw before the race how similar RJ and Jordan's stats are. Of course, they started at Factory Connection together, but they're almost on the same starts, similar podiums, wins, everything. Like they have, and they both have had a long career, of course, or, you know, road to get here. RJ maybe had, I guess on one hand, I could say Jordan had more people that believed him because he's been through so many factory teams, where you could say RJ's just had people that have stuck by him longer. But the two of them have, you know, and many times people have questioned why either of them are still getting help, why they're still on a factory team. So to see either of them pull it off, or to see potentially the two of them go down to the wire, would be so much fun.
Yeah, and just that means that both riders will know how valuable this opportunity is, and you would presume lay it all on the line. Although maybe they would have learned from past mistakes and resist the urge to lay it all on the line because they know that's not the way to do it.
I would love, and that's everything they both do lay down. If we get to like the finale and these two are within 2 or 3 points, I would love to do a sit down interview with them, like right, but like the weekend before, just to talk to them both about their path getting there. Cause they both would have like have them both sit together, cause they would both have to relate so much to what the other's been through.
Yeah, but I don't feel like RJ has been through nearly as much as Jordan.
Like I said, to a different type of what they've been through. A different type, but both starting at the same time, similar amount of time in it, but to get to run to the title at the same time. But no, Jordan has been more. That's why I said it's kind of funny to say, like, Jordan has had, RJ has kept in places longer, but I would argue Jordan has had to have more people believe in him to continue to get these different opportunities.
Yeah, and I say that about RJ, but from 2017 to 2021, he finished one Supercross season. So, there was a dark patch in there around a similar time as Jordan. Marchbanks, first podium since Orlando 2 in 2021. So, good for him, good for the Club MX team. Props to them, and they had Phil in fourth as well. So, for a satellite team, I don't think you can ask for much more. A double podium would have been nice. But you can't have everything.
Most close. But poor Phil. Phil almost had his podium. Almost. And then he just choked on the last lap. No offense, Phil. Phil choked so much on the last lap.
No, I don't know if he choked.
It was his worst lap time of the race by like 10 seconds.
Yeah, but it's a mud race. Like,
it's a mud race. But you when, have it, that when I say choke, when it, again, worst lap of the race by far. Last lap did not go good. Garrett, amazing lap. Phil just didn't execute. It is what it is. I'm not saying that to get, just it is what it is.
A lot of props go to Jordan. A lot of props go to Marchbanks. A lot of props go to Phil. All overshadowed. Mumford in fifth. I would presume that's a career best. I don't remember him being fourth before.
He ran up there a few times, but even last year when you would have good moments, he would typically fade past that to like a seventh-ish, I want to say, might have been his prior best. I'm taking a peek. I want to say seventh might have been his prior best finish.
But yeah, that was great. You know, that was
six. Six at San Diego last year, eighth at Anaheim 2, so I was close. Six at San Diego was his prior, or actually, sorry, that wasn't last year. It was the year before, 2022 on the Bar X Suzuki. He got a six in San Diego. Last year, seventh. Okay, what I was thinking was right. Last year, he got seventh, oddly enough, at a showdown at East Rutherford.
Ah, mud.
He's good at the mud. Loretta Lynn's, his pro debut is where he led a huge chunk of the moto, the really bad mudder at Loretta's.
But yeah, nice to see him in the top five for the first time. And you know what? I actually thought that Anaheim 1 was quite good for him as well. Maybe the results didn't scream that. But watching him at Anaheim 1, I felt as though he looked very racy. So maybe there's more to come from Mumford. Maybe he can get a podium. I would say that. I would enter that conversation. I think he could have a podium this year if he continues to trend in the upward direction. Agree or disagree?
Give me another round. Give me another dry round.
Okay, we'll wait for that. Speaking of which, the mud has made the 250 West standings quite bizarre because you have Mumford in fifth, Bourdon in sixth, Yoda ninth, Varese 10th, And you kind of, because of that, you're like, oh, you run out of factory riders quite quickly. But then you realize that Voland is 11th, Shimoda's 13th, Rider D is 15th. And then Phil, obviously another big name, 12th. Like, yeah, funny.
Speaking of the three factory ones named off there that odded me out so much is Rider D, Joe, and Avolin. It's so weird to see, okay, mud race, anything can happen with bikes. I was very odded out to see the three DNFs because, it was sticky mud. It wasn't a lot of water on the track, so it's not like bikes sucked water. But to watch Joe's bike die on the first lap and watch Rider D's bike make it about two more laps and then die was very strange to me. Like, no smoke, no steam, not the usual mud race. The bikes are clawing to the end and the clutches are out. But both those bikes to expire, again, one halfway through the opening lap and the other two laps later, was very, very surprising for a top team. I mean, it just shows anything can happen, literally. And again, from what I heard, Volans did not expire. It just got so jammed with mud, it basically popped the chain. Like, the drivetrain wouldn't move anymore.
Props to Rider D for his heat win as well. That was quite big.
From the glorious oasis of Bakersfield, they get a lot of rain there.
He said that, like,
never.
The one time it would rain a year, it was like an annual thing that him and his buddies would go and ride in it, no matter how bad it was. So I guess that's the reason for this.
Solid. We kept Joe, just again, for his background, I was sort of in disbelief in that heat race. Fantastic for him. Again, for somebody who thought they had the most clear career path ever, to end up at TLD this year and to have a result like that early in the year, very good for him. Again, sucks for the main, for the bike issue, but for that, it was going great.
It's always going to be difficult to comprehend the fact that this is Rider D's rookie season, and I don't know why.
It feels weird because he did the full outdoors. We saw him do 2 years of futures.
Yes, actually, I think part of the reason for that is the fact that he is number 34.
That too, getting such a low number last year off outdoors only and 2 years of futures for that, it trips up your mind a lot. Like, you look at him and go, oh, it's got to be year two. It has to be year two for Ryder. Nope, year one.
Yeah, and I can't remember if I mentioned it, but at Anaheim 1, Ryder D said that Will was saying something to him like, why did you do that line, or why are you doing this? And then had to like remind himself that, like, hey, oh, you're a rookie. You don't know what to do there. Right. Like, you know, like even under the TLD tent, it's maybe they need to put up a sign.
Yeah.
A good sign always helps.
Mud being the great equalizer, it was funny to see Bourdone almost end up with the lead at one point during the main event.
Where did he come at Anaheim 1? Because I feel like he was quite good. 11th at Anaheim 1.
10th? Yeah. Very, very solid pickup by the Barks. I tell two, even I know a 250 team that was looking for a rider for a fill-in recently. I'm like, look at Aussie Supercross riders, or look at French Supercross riders. Look outside the USA. There is amazing talent elsewhere.
I guess we should mention this is like a very nice resurgence of sorts for Bar X with Derek Drake in a 450s and Bordon in a 250s. That team has struggled to find success and struggled to find consistency and struggled to find stability over the years. And this is like a very nice start to the 2024 season that they could build on if it continues this way. So this could be their saving grace.
A huge one I'll give them a nod on is not only more solid, is even the fact that they made it through a mud race without bike issues, because I'm just going to straight say it. No offense. Last year at Outdoors, there was rounds they were pushing everything off the track. 250s, 450s, Drake's bike would just rain parts in the 450 class. 250s were blowing up left and right. I was befuddled watching that team try to get bikes to finish races. They made it through the first two rounds. It sucks. Miller hasn't probably been as good as they had hoped. Bourdon's been good. Drake's been good. The bikes have been solid. Hats off to them.
Yeah, and we gave props to Drake for making both main events, but also props to Kay Clayson and also props to Freddie Norren, who have also made both main events. Not easy to do in this field, and also not easy to do when you have such different conditions where anything can happen, and having the support of a factory team really shines through. So props to all of those riders from all of us here at VitalMX. Right, anything else stand out to you from San Francisco?
Nate Thrasher's season is abysmal.
Yep. Not much else to say. Yep.
Not good. Moseman joining next weekend, it sounds like.
Moseman is on a star bike and will be racing at some point. When will he race seems to be very confusing.
Same.
So
maybe next week, maybe 3 weeks from now, maybe 6 weeks from now. At some point, Moseman will be racing a star bike, but maybe as soon as next week, but maybe not.
I can't imagine it would be San Diego, but maybe. I don't like
it's Starman. You never know.
But then I understand why they don't want to put him on East, because they have 1,700 riders racing the East Coast. But it's not like their East Coast riders are firing on all cylinders and healthy. I mean, I hear that Bennick is flying, but obviously Styles is hurt. Romano is still finding his way back. Deegan, yeah, who knows? So
off a bike, and then Lopes, there's rumor of arm numbness again. I don't think Styles is making East. No, he posts the NRC. I don't think Styles is racing Supercross at all this year.
So maybe if I'm Star, maybe I would let Moseman have another 2 weeks to prepare and at least have him go into East Coast healthy, so you have another healthy rider in the East Coast versus putting him in the West, where really there's nothing to gain other than besides the fact that he would be a bike on the track.
Like, they might be literally just getting crap about bike on track. Because one thing, though, too, is I would argue, I don't know if 2 weeks of prep is going to help you show up for how deep East is going to be. I think, you know, there's always the argument East versus West. I think top 3 to 5-ish guys on each coast is semi-similar in skill level. But East is way deeper beyond that. They have so many, because so many teams are running, bigger teams on that coast, Triumph, that in there, everything, like... Is 2 weeks of prep going to really help him in a deep, deep East field versus maybe a little less prep and just going racing in West, where outside the top five, it's not as noticeable?
Yeah, the East is deep, but consider that so many of the star riders are limping in. Max is healthy. Faulkner is healthy. McAdoo is now healthy. Imus is healthy. Vial is healthy. But there's a lot of riders who are limping into the East Coast, so... Yeah. I don't know. Right. Good.
Good.
Thank you to Decal Works, winners of the 450 main event with Chase Sexton. Still waiting to see some sort of Sexton ship decal somewhere. But, you know, we've got 29 more rounds for it to appear. So I'm more than happy to be patient. Thank you to Fox Racing, who had incredible gear at the weekend. Of course they did. They're Fox Racing. They will probably have incredible gear in San Diego as well. And thank you to Beta. By the way, Benny Bloss rode very, very, very well in the LCQ on his Beta. Oh,
basically dead last to one spot away from it, fifth.
Yep. And you can bet your bottom dollar that he counted on the top quality and rideability of the 450 RX to do that. So thank you to those brands for supporting what we do here at VitalMX. Thank you to you people for patiently waiting for this podcast. We will be back next week to discuss San Diego with myself, Lewis Phillips, and Jamie Guida, of all people. So look forward to that. We will see you then. Cheers.